This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, February 25th, 2009.
Started. Good afternoon. Make sure that if you haven't done so already, that you've signed in on the clipboard. And we'll get started. Is there any constituent assembly reports from the SA?
Not here either, so if you have any.
GPSA?
I guess I'll just note a few things. So at the last assembly meeting, which I can't actually tell you how these came out because I wasn't able to make the meeting, but there was a resolution that just clarified that the student assembly's resolution to put a moratorium on new student groups actually doesn't apply to groups with greater than 40% of graduate and professional students. So I can't tell you how that resolution came out. I can speculate, but I can't tell you. And there was also a resolution to encourage the registrar to consider making February 19th observing Martin Luther King Jr. Day on February 19th.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. And that came to Bill, actually. That's it? Anything from the EA?
I have nothing to report.
And Faculty Senate?
You could. Last Faculty Senate meeting, there was an enlightening discussion of the budget by Provost Fox. And until the minutes, I guess, are issued, I'll just suggest that it has a lot of detail in it. His presentation, some of it is, most of it is actually available in the statement that he made, and it's well worth studying closely.
And if it's not there, it's in the sun.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Call for late additions. You had an item ready?
Yes. And my cohort who's interested in having this proposed. Yes, Elizabeth. Yes. Okay. If there is time in this agenda, and we've discussed whether there might be and there might well be, we'd like to have assembly look at a resolution about a Senate resolution that is going to be proposed in the next meeting. It's already been circulated, just to see if you're willing to put in a word of support for the resolution. But we'll do that as a late addition.
Okay. All right, first on our topic is the discussion of the BUHS resolution. And with us today, we have Sharon Dippin. You may. And Seth can't be here.
I've been in correspondence.
Yep.
I think
do you want to undertake resolution?
We constructed a resolution that comes in a form that's quite similar to the form of the Sustainability Committee, and this is a way of adjusting the UHS to fit the current status of various councils on health that exist in different areas of the university. And Sharon and Seth and I have been writing back and forth a bit about this, and Sharon's most recent correspondence is one that we'll have to discuss because, and there's a long history about this, the BUHS is one of our standing committees, and it is one that fell into a quietude for a while, partly because the proliferation of committees and active groups in different sectors of the university having to do with health was developed over the past 10, 15 years. And the attempt in this resolution is to develop a committee which is more streamlined, but which still fulfills the responsibilities of the relationship between the university assembly and health services that's spelled out in the charter. I don't want to anticipate what Sharon has to say, but I'll say right off that some of the correspondence has been whether or not this committee, in fact, is still too cumbersome to be able to be, not streamlined enough, I guess you could say, to be able to be, to meet the needs of the reporting relationship, and whether or not it should be streamlined down to just one person. I can say that my statement about that is that the charter doesn't permit that for a standing committee of the assembly. But more than that, when we put together this and before that, the sustainability committee, one of the thoughts that came to me was that if we cut the membership of these committees down to four, which is the minimum size for this for committees under the charter, then we still have relatively streamlined. Moreover, we have the advantage of them representing each of the constituencies. And what we need to do then is be sure that the four people who are chosen by the respective assemblies are eager to do the work that the committee is required to do. So what is the work the committee is required to do? It's to bring to the university assembly, well, first of all, to discuss amongst itself issues that pertain to the health, various health areas of health concerned in the university, and decide whether any of those issues rise to the level of needing university assembly action in the form of a resolution to of any sort that we think is useful. Let me take, for example, gorge safety. That's not a health issue, but it is, of course, if you die and or if you're maimed by that. But it's particularly being dealt with by the Codes and Judicial Committee now. The Codes and Judicial Committee has assembled all the information, and it's decided that it's important enough issue that it wants to bring it to the University Assembly for changing the campus code. Something similar, though we don't have the equivalent of a health code, to the campus code, something similar could occur in the area of health, that this smaller committee, streamlined committee, could decide is a campus-wide issue that needs to be addressed by the University Assembly in the form of a resolution which goes to the President, something that's... So that's the compromise that's come about. Now, it may be, and that, I'll turn it over to you now for whatever thoughts you might have, Sharon, about that.
Thank you for letting me come and join you. I'm hoping we can just have a problem-solving conversation, because this is a long-standing problem that I think has actually come between health services and the UA in a way that doesn't meet either of our goals, which is for us to be in close connection around issues related to the health and well-being of the community. And I've been at Gannett for 20 years, so I've seen some real history around this, and I recognize several of you who sat through the conversation we had last year about this time. Some of you have been engaged in conversations about the Board of University Health for even longer than that. Our goal is to find a way to be in direct relationship with the UA. And what we found over many years was that the committee structure, which was unsustainable because there weren't interested members, we the UA had trouble recruiting people. We had trouble getting people united in their interests because we have people at the table who were very interested in mental health, but not really very interested in student insurance. They were very interested in alcohol and other drug issues, but didn't want to hear at all about sexual health. So you'd have people who are interested in health, but not broadly interested. You had faculty who were involved who were very interested in occupational medicine services, but the grad students at the table were thinking, why are we talking about this? We've got issues related to insurance for our partners. So there wasn't common ground to support the work of the committee. I think, like other UA committees, that structure of having people sign up and say, I want to be part of this committee wasn't really working. And so we, with others that both involved with the university assembly as well as the student assembly, started creating some short-term task groups to address particular issues, and then some longer-term standing committees, such as the Council on Mental Health and Welfare, which has representatives of undergrad, grad, staff, and faculty, the President's Council on Alcohol and Other Drugs, similarly representatives, and the Student Insurance Advisory Committee, representatives from all the groups. This drew together people who had shared concerns about a dimension of health where they could come together and feel like their commitment was rewarded so they could actually focus on issues and bring things forward. So, for instance, the President's Council on Alcohol and Drugs did help inform the revision of the code. So they brought issues forward. The GPSA has worked through the Student Insurance Advisory Committee to identify issues of particular concern to graduate and professional students and their dependents. And I think we've made some progress there around issues, including the student insurance being provided to graduate students is something that came out of a united effort. So we've got these groups that are able to advance the issues that are of most concern to the community. What we don't have is a regular opportunity for us, Gannett Health Services staff members, and you, our university assembly representatives, to sit at the table together and say, are you concerned about issues? Should we be working together to facilitate a conversation about things that have come to you? And the only thing that the Board on University Health did was give us another exercise to conduct over at Gannett without you. So what I'm most interested in is seeing us come up with a solution to the challenge of maintaining a dynamic, active, engaged leadership role together. Our elected representatives and the department that's been commissioned to have responsibility not only for providing services to individuals, but for protecting the public health of the community. I want to see us have an opportunity to be engaged in that together in a way that benefits both organizations. It's possible that this structure would do it. One grad student, one staff member, one faculty member. I'm not really seeing how that will work. I know we can't tap you because you're already tapped in multiple directions, as I just witnessed with the reports from the GPSA and the Faculty Senate. You're already on subcommittees with this group, but having us together try to find four people who, as Marty was saying, might be representatives of these constituencies. How do we find people who are representative of the constituencies?
We have this problem.
Who then have shared interests.
We have this problem. We will have it later in this meeting, or not problem, this question, when we're talking about staffing the Sustainability Committee. But the way that the Sustainability Committee, and actually all of our committees are set up, is that we have a liaison convener from the UA, who is not a voting member, whose responsibility it is to bring the committee to order, I guess you could say. But the appointments on the different committees come out of the different assemblies. And I mean, the advantage to this, of course, would be that the assemblies would find people in their groups or either people serving on the assembly who have an interest in the health issue or a sustainability issue, and then appoint them as one of those four members, or that they would find someone in the community, undergraduate staff and so forth, who would serve in that role. Now, if you have a four-person committee, then a quorum is 2-3. I don't know, I suppose that could be decided. Getting a couple of people together to discuss an issue and then having the flexibility of developing a larger committee if you find it's necessary, but in the case of what you're discussing, it's not, because what you're interested in really is just to have the committee discuss, have this group discuss what would be a useful issue to bring to the UA. They would decide, and then there would be a report made by the UA liaison along with the committee member. With the Code of Judicial Committee, the way it worked was that the liaison came to the UA meeting, or was in the UA meeting, presented the issues that had to be considered by the UA. There were members of the Code of Judicial Committee who came along, presented their work, and the UA then discussed and debated it. So I'm wondering, the alternative might be, what the alternative might be, would it be a periodic report by somebody from the board, from Gannett, about what's going on at Gannett and what we would like to do? That could not that be directed through the this kind of a mechanism? One of the things that can happen, for example, is you already have committees. You have faculty, staff, students on your committees. With the Family and Children's Service Committee that we established last year, the committee consisted mostly of people who already were serving and that represented its respective constituencies. One could imagine that happening in your case as well. People engaged in particular issues, and then they would say, meeting together, representatives, however, as a committee, they would say, look, this issue really ought to go to the UA for publicity purposes, for mobilization purposes, however you want to put it, and then that would be brought immediately here. Does that sound...
I think that's a possibility. Dave Krasuski, who's a member of the UA last year, and Ari and I met a few times to talk about the possibility of a liaison relationship rather than a committee structure, so that there would actually be a member of the UA who would work with a member of Gannett to sweep up issues that might come through you or through the other assemblies to the UA that would be health-related, and I, as an example, as a member of our staff, would sweep up issues related to the committees, the standing committees that I mentioned, as well as some of the task groups that are shorter-term, more focused on a specific issue, so that we could just work together on identifying what are the issues that are being discussed in our constituent groups, as well as in the within health services and the health-related committees. We thought there might be some advantage to that because it would actually be a UA person and a point person at Gannett that would meet regularly. And one of our problems with the committee structure, and you guys know this well, is when you don't have people who are there all the time and you're dealing with very complex issues related to, we have so many federal state mandates now and things that are sort of expectations out of college health, and now we've got issues related to occupational medicine and research that's going on the campus. It's very difficult when you have people in and out of those conversations to get very far. So we thought it might be desirable to try a system where there was one point person who was very actively engaged as a representative from the UA, and then could draw us in. The other thing that used to be quite effective was we would come once a year and present an overview report of some of the highlights that we were encountering, as well as challenges we were encountering in health services, and engage the UA, get feedback. We actually spun off a few smaller subgroups that had representatives from the different assemblies as a result of some of those conversations. So I'm not here to say I want you to choose that solution. I'm just not really sure what to do. I believe that a committee structure is challenging, but I am certainly willing to try that again if this body feels that that's the way we need to go.
I have a recommendation. So you're not opposed to us at least minimizing the committee as far as we need to go with the current charter and see how that works?
I'm happy to give that a go.
Okay. James?
I was just going to ask, this committee, which has not met in the longest time, due to, you know, but now we have three functioning committees that are working in their areas. And it sounds like they have representation from the four groups as they go. What would this committee, even a minimized one, really do other than to go and round up people from all the other ones and go, what are you doing this month? What are you doing this month? Is there any, you know, it sounds to me like it's just a level of interface that isn't got its own mission other than to corral issues together and bring things forward, which I think these groups should know they can do independently. So unless I'm missing a mission that's not being met, it sounds like the mission's being met and it's the connection that's broken. And I don't think we need a four-person committee for a connection. But I understand the bylaw issue. It kind of traps us a little bit. I like the idea of, you know, extending it once a year, twice a year, once a quarter, or as pushed from these three committees, come talk to us or canvassing it and appointing a UA liaison that, you know, will touch base with these committees on a regular basis to see if there's anything that should be pushed or help facilitate the process. I don't know how to do that and escape our committee obligations unless you designate these three as dual-hatted committees themselves if they meet the criteria. But there's a layer there that we shouldn't need. And I don't, as a matter of process, I'm sure, you know, you can upsteer us, but...
Well, I think Ari, you recommended that we change the charter, right? Isn't that part of the...
The committee charter is part of the charter, isn't it?
Pardon me?
Isn't that charter the committee part of the charter?
Yes,
but I'm saying that we'd have to change the charter in order to adjust the numbers, in order to pare it down, the committee, from just four voting members.
Yeah, I mean, or you could just say, you know, except where otherwise specified by committee charges in the charter, or something to that effect. If you're amending the charter to change the structure of the committee, you could also amend the charter to make an exception for this committee. I think, you know, you get towards a more fundamental question about what is the relationship the University Assembly wants to take on with University Health Services, sorry, Gannett Health Services, and, you know, what kind of structure would best serve that relationship. And it's not just health services. None of these, when this relationship was created, the University Assembly had a governing role over these organizations. It was the budget. It was like a miniature board for these institutions, and it has not functioned in that role for 20 years. And yet, that's still what it says on the books, is the University Assembly's role. So, I mean, it also gets to a fundamental question of, you know, what is your vision for how you want to interact with University Health Services? Do you you want a regular reporting relationship that requires any standing connection.
But we can't, in this current resolution, set it to a liaison without changing the whole setup of the charter, right?
Yeah. And I'm, you know, it's a fair question. If personally, I think, as much as I feel bad with Karen, you know, having come to yet another meeting, I think the first time she brought these concerns was in 2004, so 4 years. None of the undergraduate representatives who are here at the time were even students at Cornell back then. Some of you might not have even been in high school yet. so, you know, she's been waiting a long time for direction from the UA about what kind of relationship does it want to take on with health services. And so I think, you know, if there isn't any consensus yet or feeling of, you know, what is our role going to be with University Health Services, URW, all these things, that a very different role was prescribed from what you have right now in the charter, maybe a better question would be, can we form a committee to study that and figure that question out, or if not a committee, some sort of process?
And I would recommend, just to double tap that, that we table this, send it to the executive committee to discuss in-house what they think the relationship needs to be. We've got three function committees. What kind of connection would they recommend that we take on? Seeing how for 20 years, obviously, they're doing well. The question is, can we facilitate the business better or not? Do we need a structure for it? And then make recommendations to the larger board next meeting or two meetings hence about what we might do. Because structure should not get in the way of doing the right thing by people, but we don't need structure just because we all know healthcare and these issues are important. We're an important committee who does important stuff, so therefore we need a committee to look after this. That's for 20 years. So we need to fundamentally decide, is a committee needed? If yes, what the relationship should be, and then fix the paperwork. And I think it starts really with an in-house executive committee discussion, about what they think we should do, because obviously it's not easily solved. But the paperwork, this resolution doesn't conform yet, and I don't see a consensus around the room about this committee that should be important, that has no role other than to check in with three other committees and see if there's anything to report.
But that committee wouldn't be checking in with three other committees. It would be a liaison with the staff member.
Sure. Right? But if we're going to look at this, I mean, the executive committee, again, we're supposed to have a budget and all this other oversight. We haven't done it. They haven't. If they suffer, and it's not been so much that they're dysfunctional. So either we need to totally rework this, or we need to go, no, this is right, and by golly, we need to drum up the support to do it right. I don't see the latter happening, but it's not outside the realm of possibility. Bottom line is, I think it needs some intellectual capital, and I would recommend first from the executive committee before we start setting up a committee to study it. It needs leadership before it needs a committee.
Well, we're running out of time to discuss this, but one of the things I want to bring to the attention is that the board, the present statement of the about the Board of University Health Services is that it has primary responsibility for debating and formulating changes in policies. It doesn't mention the budget, but I suppose the policy.
Well, I'm talking about, you know, the legacy that the UA inherited, which was from 1969. There was something there was a great change in how the governance system worked. And then after a certain amount of time, something like 7 years, basically the volunteer predecessor to the university assembly said, this is too much responsibility for us to do as volunteers, and it was restructured. But there was this idea, still with this legislative authority, that the policy direction and the leadership and guidance of these units was coming from the university assembly.
Yes.
And like I said, there has been no substantive leadership. There has not been one policy recommendation to any of these units, except for the campus code, an important exception. But, you know, if that's the only thing the university assembly is going to substantively affect, then it should be, you know, I don't know, the campus code assembly. So my question is...
Well, the thing that what I was simply saying is that it may have been evolved. In fact, our charter comes much later than 1969, and the charter, as it's defined, has that wording and not something about budget and so forth. I think, can sit down as an executive committee, and I suggest you're right that we table this and the executive committee look at this. But I think, James, you'd be a great addition to discuss it with us.
I'd be glad to do it.
Fine. So I move to table it. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. In favor?
Yeah.
There's no debate on tabling as far as I'm aware.
She wanted to add something in really quickly.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. If I may, just very, very quickly, I am not out of patience. I'm happy to keep talking. What I long for is the day when we are talking about how we together can be addressing the health issues of this community. And I got my partners behind me from the wellness program who I know would like to be part of that too. I think there's a great opportunity that we haven't yet embraced for the university assembly to stake out some territory mm-hmm. in this area, to work with us to convene some community fora and other opportunities for addressing some of the issues that really matter to all of us, and they can be supported by these committees that are already working. But we've got some wonderful opportunities that can support the health of our organizations if we could figure out how to do this right, rather than having something that had come to feel like a parking lot.
Well, I think we feel that way about all our committees. except the Chosen Judicial Committee, and in some of them we're taking a little more action than we had in years before, I think one of our hopes is that we'll be vigorously engaged in all of these activities, and that we'll, so maybe what we need to say is that you and anyone else you feel should be a part of any kind of executive committee conversation, and it may not be the whole executive committee, maybe one or two of us, along with James and people you feel, to try and construct a resolution or amend this one to make it more workable for us all. Thank you.
If you wouldn't mind, I would like to be part of that as well.
Terrific.
Since I think this issue will extend into not just with this committee, but with other committees into next year. Mm-hmm. Since I think I'm the only undergraduate coming back next year, I don't know if anyone else is considering fall elections, but as of right now, I'm the only returning undergraduate. I don't really like to see where that heads.
Well, we think Mark's been doing a good job, except that some professors he isn't passing.
Okay, so you can expect in a week or so, before the week's out, we'll get together a group. We're on notice. Within a week, we're going to be getting together a group to discuss this with you. Thank you very much.
Try and send out an email. I'm not here next week.
I can do it. I'll do it. And Seth and I can be the representatives if you want.
That's fine. That works.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming, Sharon.
Thank you all.
Did you get some pizza?
It's health food.
It's health food. That's the first thing we
need to know. Resolution for
veggie pizza.
I didn't see that.
Okay, catch it, right?
Yeah. That would be made of. Let's move on to.
That's what it's made of.
Okay. Move on to the liaison of the USC. The University Sustainable Committee.
I know we have a volunteer.
Yeah, but I'd like to ask everybody, being the one that put this on the table, I'd really love it if somebody here wanted to be the convener and liaison to the Sustainability Committee. But what it would involve at the outset is... going to the various people that are going to be putting together the committee for five people and pulling the committee together. I've done some legwork on it already. I've talked with Professor DeSalvo, who's the head of the Sustainable Future Group, and then Dean Koyanagi is already on board to find somebody. So that's two of the five members. But it involves also approaching the assemblies to get three other members, and the Senate to get total six members, yeah, to get four other members in place. And I think the sooner the better for this committee, just so that it can get to work. Is anybody terrifically excited about that prospect and willing to put time into it and getting it going? Okay.
Yeah.
So you and I can. Pardon me?
Yeah, definitely interested.
Okay. So you and I can converse about the contacts already made. And but as far as these SA and GPSA and EA reps, and I guess I'll talk to the Faculty Senate. The reps here who are here, who's are they? There's people from every one, right? Okay. Could you move as quickly as possible to approach your assemblies to get somebody? And the view would be, you know, as Sharon was saying, the need is to get somebody who's really excited about this particular issue or combination of issues. They can be, you know, focused on one area, but they have to also be broadly a little bit breadth in their approach to sustainability to get them on board as committee members. And then you can send emails to Alex and myself about what's the results of your contacts with your respective assemblies.
Sure, I was just going to add that we have a very active environmental committee right now that's pretty much been spearheading a lot and working up
right.
As well with Mike Walsh.
Right.
So we can definitely forward this on to them. And they have a whole host of undergraduates, not just on the assembly, but just people interested as well that may be interested in serving.
Yeah, it's exciting that that's going on, and I think we really want to be engaged with that. This is this committee will have a slightly different role. Not to say that it won't be complementary, and it certainly won't be conflicting. It will be complementary, and the person who is chosen out of that group or who volunteers out of the group should know that their role will be to integrate with other constituent groups on the campus, the particular concern that your group, the environmental committee is working on in the student in the student assembly. You know what I mean? As opposed to, we could get on board so forth. But the main thing will be bring the news and then right.
I was just saying we have people that are interested.
Terrific.
Not
terrific.
And actually, Ryan is sort of aware that was going to be coming down the pike because I talked to him about that.
As far as at-large students, I don't remember the general makeup of this committee.
It's two.
Will it be an application process? Because I know for the rest of the university committees, students can apply online through the assembly's website.
Right now what we have is individual assemblies will appoint one member, two members from students, right? Two members, undergraduate.
Wasn't it?
One from each student assembly, two employees, two faculty. Is that right? Yes.
There was six people total. Yeah.
Right. Two employees, two faculty. The one from each student assembly, two employees, two faculty. This is all a part of the streamlined committee approach that we were talking about in the last one. And the point is that in the language of this this committee, forming of the committee, the idea is that it can be expanded. So if this committee gets together and it says we want to work on bottled water, let's say, they may add members to either subcommittee structure or ad hoc members to the committee itself. and whether it's done on an application basis or not, that's for the committee to decide. Yes. The faculty members, may I say, are prescribed as one from the Center for Sustainable Future and one appointed by the faculty Senate group, either through the FCR or some other way. The employee members are one from the Environmental Sustainability Compliance Office, which is Dean Koyanagi's group, and one employed by the Employee Assembly.
So we actually have to have a resolution?
Not a resolution, a vote, you mean?
No, we're just going to have a
vote. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we found the person. Is that acceptable?
Everybody agreed on that?
Okay. We can work together.
Okay. That'll be for Alex to do the liaison work for the USC.
And convening.
And convening. Okay. Next on the list is the Cornell store coming to give us a little presentation, because we haven't seen them since last year. Margie and
this is Gary Fisher, deputy director of the Cornell store and my strategy manager.
Did you need to hook up to the screen?
I don't think so.
We decided on
the conversation, so we can give you our preliminary information.
Okay.
Can we just pull up a little bit here?
Please do.
Did I feel like at a phone because I
wasn't? No.
20. Yeah, maybe a little bit of a cut.
Just dated it out here.
Could be my job. There's one more.
Yeah,
we're all set. I've got those extras. You know, I'll be down the door again.
So the presentation is really good to take home with you. There's nothing, very well, I'll drill on a couple of slides, but then we really just want to talk. We continue, and most of this were in multi-year processes with this, so strategic initiatives smell a lot like they were last year, where they're just rolling forward. We are very data-driven. We benchmark ourselves. We measure a lot. We compare with other stores. We compare favorably, I'm happy to say, in most cases. There's some of the great things we've done this year. I'll note that the top one, that's award given in conjunction with the ACE, the American Council on Education, that looks for outstanding examples of collaboration and deployment among universities, and that's the fact that College Stories hit the big time there, we're pretty excited about, and that's something that we've led substantially. The slide that I really want to look at a little bit is the financial model, and to talk a little bit about the current business climate and the current university budget and its impact. You know, we're not immune, unfortunately, from what's going on. You'll see that our contribution. Margie, you want to come over? Our contribution to the university increased last year. We're happy to be able to do that. Our reserve or our overheads went up slightly. The extra support is that we funded some special projects out of our reserves, so that's a substantial increase. And that looks like it's going to be likely to continue. So we're fortunate enough to have reasonable reserves against renovations, and you know, we're entirely self-funded. At some point, we've got to, you know, it's out of our control, but we can get to the point where we're not going to be able to fund the continuing capital needs. And we're far away from that, but it's a concern that I have, particularly that next year our overheads will go up by $500,000, so we're kind of getting chewed out of a little bit on both ends. I'm not here to ask you to do anything about that, but when textbook prices go up even higher, we've only got $4 of money.
But could you explain which way the money's going on these rows of your overhead or cost to use?
Yes.
Is that flowing from you to the university?
Yes.
in several different directions, different buckets that we fund, some to CUFA, some to...
CUFA?
Whatever we are.
The Division
And then the next line, which way does that money flow?
That money is actually going to fund from, and I can't even tell you exactly what these are. In Hoopa's great wisdom, they say we got stuff on an extraordinary fund and we don't have other sources of funding. And you guys have been really good to us in the past. And I mean, that's part of why we're here, is to return the money to the university in addition to providing what we hope is first grade service to
So in that sense, when you say textbook prices are going up, in part of that is that the university is actually
I need to be careful. I was being a wise.
No, but I think textbook prices are, if there's a complaint about Cornell Store, that is, I think, valid, is that the textbooks are brutally expensive on top of a brutally expensive education. And in, so some, I don't think it's transparent, actually, that in a sense, not only are textbooks not covered in this tuition, but they're another tax, partly tax, back into the university budget. So it's worth for the undergraduates to take that message home, and it's and maybe it's not appropriate for the university to ask you for to be a money source, because it turns into a tax on the students. If they're going to tax the students, they should do it up front, raise their tuition, and not hide it in the campus store.
That's been a low percentage play for me to engage in this conversation, but it is true that and it's not inappropriate that the store be self-funding and perpetuate itself. It's not uncommon. In fact, it's more than common that on universities across the country, colleges across the country, the store returns a contribution to the university. There are outsourced models that we, in a sense, compete with, that our return to the university should be on par, we think, and the service we provide should be as good or better than what the university could get by going to something like this. There is a point, though, where any company can only produce what's a reasonable return from a company. And in a bookstore's case, we're right at that number, the magic number. You know, we're sitting very, we're nice competitively. We're actually a little bit better. There, the question is, and I think it's a fair one, is one, how much further can we take that and keep the business sustainable, or how much further can we take that and what's the impact on our customers? And which further, frankly, erodes our competitive position, you know, so you can see where you start. It's not quite a death spiral, but it's a bad trend. Another glib thing to say would be that Marjorie and Katana, Cornell makes more money on textbooks than we do. You know, it's not a big money, but you know, that's not a money making category for us. It's a low margin, and I need to go through the whole where the textbook value thing goes with you guys. But,
although we can, I mean, we should take questions if people don't understand.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind knowing that.
So, about 73 cents of every textbook dollar goes right out the door to the publisher. I mean, that's the cost of goods. Another point and a half to 2 points of that is in freight. Our overheads in total are probably five plus percent. We pay a couple of percent to Visa or for the Bursar card, and then we do keep the lights on and have people around showing textbooks and things like that. So you can see that's very little. Our true contribution to our overhead from textbooks is pretty modest. I mean, it's $8 million for our business. It's a good slug of our business, but we have other product categories that are profitable.
And this year, 10% of everything,
the whole budget goes
back
to the university. And that's kind of market price. I mean, that's pretty good.
If you separated out textbooks, which you've done, obviously, mm-hmm. from everything else you sell, including computers and things of that sort, what percentage of the material, the money that goes back to the university comes from textbook, what comes from the non-textbook?
Well, you could parse it any way you want. We could say 100% of it comes from non-textbooks, but, you know, then it's a really big percent of the other pieces of our business, and they typically are higher margin. That's something we can sell at a higher margin than we do textbooks. We could slice it and dice it and say...
But could you cut across textbooks if you'd have to put a higher price on the non-textbook, is what you're saying, in order to make up the difference? Or is it a fixed percentage of everything you sell that has to be returned?
The model itself, I can't speak to exactly how it's calculated. I just know, I see the big number. There is a method. I don't know what it is. Our computer product sales are actually exempted from that because the margins on that are in the sub 5-6% range, and 1-2% on hardware and most of our software. And so that's just not possible. We get out of the business if we have to pay the rent on it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to speak as impolitically as I may, but think that it's 5% of our textbook cost. You know, it's a fair way to think about it. This is a bad time to go to Cornell and say, suck it up.
Yeah,
you're not going to get as much from the store. You know, this is an interesting discussion. I don't know that it's...
Good. So I'm wondering if... I think a lot of more competitors now than you used to because of Amazon and reselling over the internet and so on. I'm wondering if it would make sense for Cornell to stop being a textbook seller altogether and contract and eliminate the idea that it stocks its own textbooks and it's in this market. And just contract it out to Amazon and eliminate this painful part of your activity. This isn't something that I can imagine the campus store is going to want to propose, but it's something that could potentially save $100 per undergraduate for the undergraduates, $100 per student per semester even, if they could buy these things without this extra tax on
them. Well, we say that $50 maybe? Tops, if we say a student spends $1,000 a year, it could be $50. I don't think that, the reason we still do what we guess is about 80-85%, we provide about 80-85% of the textbooks that are purchased by the student community here. And it's not just because you can get them anywhere else. You know, we do, I'd like to bring some value to the table in terms of aggregation, consolidation. Amazon does not carry everything. You can't pay by front. It's convenient, it's quick, you can buy it whenever you want. Anyway, we've got a value proposition, and I'd be really nervous about, get us out of the textbook business, take this pain off our shoulders, and that's not what we're saying at all. I'd much rather be talking about ways. There are some things that we can do as a community, as the store certainly, but as a community, to address textbook costs. And one of them would be to take the overhead off. That's a pretty broad stroke, and that would result in some serious money for each individual student. The other would be, and we touched on this the last time we were here, is that used books save money. Used books sell for 25% less than the cost of a new book. Used book supply is scarce compared to new book supply. The way to get more used books is to buy more from your students. Students win twice. They get to buy used books, they get to sell them back. And we can only buy books back from students if we know what's going to be used in the coming semester. We can buy from multiple sources in the open market used books. The longer we're in that market, the higher the incidence of being able to get hit and get stuck. So these, and I agree that they seem ridiculous and arbitrary early deadlines for course material submissions, really are designed to help us maximize the source of used books and maximize the amount of detailed students. Again, that's a, we have to be really careful. You know, we're the book butlers. We're not the curriculum consultants. You know, we're not here to dictate what materials are used or what decisions that you make. But it would be to all of our benefits to, you know, that's a question, is what can we do as a community to increase our on-time adoption? By the time we buy books back in May, the beginning of May, we'll know about 44% of the titles that we used in August. That's just not good enough. You know,
okay, we're actually segueing to the next point on the last page of the handout.
No.
Talking about the purchase.
Absolutely.
I want to go back to the textbook. If let's say the amount of money you have to pay the university stays constant.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to see that stay constant with taking textbooks out of that, because textbooks aren't really an option. But everything else is an option. And that gives the students an option to pay the tax. But otherwise, they're required to pay a tax that I'm sure nobody knows they're paying and nobody's happy to pay. Maybe everybody's happy.
Oh, I think that's really possible. I mean, but it, right now it's going to be more semantic than anything to say, okay.
That's right. That's right.
5% across the board and 12.5% on these product categories.
But it's sort of like the fair tax. You then choose if you want to pay a tax. You can buy a sweatshirt or a pen or a pad of paper, but you don't have to pay a tax on textbooks.
So just make textbooks a zero sum game.
Yep. Well, reduce the price by 5%.
There needs to be there is some tax. They got to move the books out, store the books. But, I mean, there is a cost to doing that business, but it doesn't have to necessarily carry that payback to the university.
That's right. Just that's why. That's all.
Which is, if I understand correctly, at least in theory, approximately 5%. As it sums up currently.
I guess my question is, and I know we mentioned it, just looking over, I guess, for years, a five-year plan with the more, you know, usability of Facebook and other applications where students, I mean, most students I know, when they sell back books now, are selling them to other students who are working for different companies compared to going back to the Cornell store, because I know that, you know, for a Spanish book, I'm only getting like $10 when it was much more than that, where I could get from a private business, you know, $20 more than that. So I was just wondering if looking at a yearly process, if the money that we've been making on books has been going down significantly because of crashes, because of the other options that are available.
No, it hasn't. There's no doubt that our share of the textbook market is shrinking, and that's in line with almost every college and university store across the country. It's also true that textbook prices continue to go up. And so some of that decline in units is masked by the increase in prices. And so when we do the math and look on a book-to-book basis, we're probably declining at the rate of 1 to 1.5% a year. And that's been happening over the course of about 5 years. We're concerned that trend will accelerate to some extent by peer-to-peer or other competitors. But to a greater extent, and we don't know, I don't think anybody in this room could guess what the impact of digital delivery on course materials are, whether that's the silver bullet or not. I've been in the business for over 20 years, and for 20 years we've been saying, it's almost here. Boy, just one more breakthrough or one more change in the business model, and digital is going to take over. Sooner or later, that's going to be true. But I don't, you know, we think it's closer than it was 20 years ago, I guarantee that. And there's enough evidence in the market today to suggest that we sold 60 units of e-books in January. It's pretty modest, and I don't see that, but it could change really, really quickly based on devices and the product availability. In that case, now we're talking about a tiny retail price and a much smaller margin still. So our ability to sustain that business becomes, you know, somewhat questioned. But I don't know how to get this across either. There's perception about our prices. There's perception about what we pay at buyback that we don't think squares with the reality. And it's kind of hard to be the big bad wolf, the monopolistic, rapacious Cornell store in textbooks, and then say, but believe us when we tell you, you know, we're a pretty good deal. We're on net. We're doing a good job. And there are, you know, the used book business is tough. There are all these cases where our pricing, we're buying for a class, we can only take 50, but then we're paying $10 for something else. So it's a hard message to get across. We can say with confidence we pay higher prices for work books than anybody else. And, you know, that's not a big fat line. It's not even a little tiny line. It's the truth.
We're running short.
Sure, I know.
So
this is always a discussion that you know, all your.
What's one or two challenges for the bookstore? I did look at these, but I don't see where there's like any challenges that you say you're sharing with us. So what's one or two of your top challenges?
Well, we have a number of challenges. One is that based on, and again, I'm not complaining, university overhead, and it's great to work for an organization that's committed to paying people good wages and paying good benefits. But that puts us on a way uneven footing with our competitors who have much lower cost of doing business, who are paying people $8 an hour to work 20 hours a week and not get benefits, or who are selling out of their garage, and none of those things are a concern. And that's not, they're bad, but our built-in cost of doing business is higher than many of our competitors, which means we have to be smarter and more nimble and, you know, more process-driven, and that's okay with us. But the pressure on that just continues. The economy right now, you know, guess what? We all know that. It stinks. And our business has declined in those categories that we talk about, the discretionary categories, clothing and everything else, things like that. You know, in October, we started to see the same trend as everything else in the country. So that stuff where we look to make our margin is very, very soft right now, understandably so. So we're hostage to that broader retail market.
Just one last question.
Yeah.
Does it look like you're going to be laying off any full-time or regular employees?
It doesn't look like it. And so we're an enterprise unit, and we're technically not held to the 5% or 10% reduction cost.
Okay. But we get the draw on our reserves.
The draw and the increase in overhead. So it's produce more, not spend less. And part of producing more could be spending less. I'll say that one of the reasons why our financials compare so well to our peer stores across the country is that we took our medicine, you know, over the last 6 or 7 years. Our headcount has declined by more than 40%, mostly through attrition, because we've been able to do it all the time. And we look around and say, I don't know where we're going to cut money. We could be a little more. There's this much laying around. We've got to use the money off working. So that's a challenge.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Is there
welcome the opportunity to sure. Talk to you. So if there are particular topics you would like us to address in the future,
and you're also open to discussion with anybody who has further questions.
That's kind of where we left last time, and we've
right.
Caught up with Mark once or twice.
Right.
We'd love to have some formal or informal. I don't want any formal. I just like we went down that street, and it wasn't that much fun. But, how do we engage with faculty, and not broadly, but even on a small level, to say what can we do? How do we engage better with students? I mean, we're in this for the good of the order. You know?
I think the committee ought to, your liaison ought to work on that with you. And we can use this. Pardon me.
What we had tried doing, I remember we had this discussion last year. You know, several times we came back, and I kind of put forward the idea of what you've been expressing is that, you know, need for pushing deadlines, kind of
for faculty to kind of, you know, be more.
Well, maybe you could work on some kind of dispatch that we could.
Well,
we could,
my concern is that when we discussed this for about 10, 20 minutes last year, it was met with basically unanimous. Everybody was against it. Every faculty was very much against having deadlines, and we reached this brick wall on it.
We've had a good presentation, and maybe you can discuss maybe a resolution
sure.
we could put together, or at least
that's
some kind of bulletin that we could put out from the UA. Great.
I just want to add to that. Also, there's also faculty is not the only constituency here on this campus. There's also students and staff.
Yeah.
So let's not forget those folks either.
Right. Well, that's what we should do. We should put together a statement of some sort.
The problem is getting faculty in order to do it in a timely manner involves faculty consenting, not the other constituencies. So that's
well,
kind of a problem.
All
right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was a little...
Do it on additional.
I
we got to move quickly, folks, to the next item. Beth? Beth.
Welcome.
Does anyone need like a little stretch break?
No, we have to go.
We
only have 5 minutes.
I'm going to smoke you up here.
I'll try to do this fast. I'm Beth McKinney, and I want to thank you for letting me put this item on the table, literally. I'm the director of the wellness program. I'm here as the director of the wellness program and certified health education specialist, and I've brought Nina Doyle with me, who works in the wellness program as health education specialist, and she also runs all of the smoking cessation counseling that we do for staff and faculty. A little bit of history, and that is that it has been suggested by, I guess, a couple different employees and wound up on the employee assembly priority list to look into, should Cornell University be a smoke-free campus? And I saw that priority list, and they actually passed it off to the wellness program last year, and I let it go for a year, and then I kind of picked it up again as something that the wellness program ought to address. So pretty much they gave it to me. In chatting with Rodney, I mentioned it, and he said, well, that's something that should really come to the university assembly, which of course is makes sense. So here we are, and what the reason why Ruth and I are here now is to throw out this idea and give you some pros and cons and to have the discussion. Because number one, we are Cornell University. We're interested in sustainability. This is a sustainability issue, it's a health issue, and it's worth discussing. So I'm not coming here to push it one way or the other, but just to let you know that I'm putting it in your hands. So in a nutshell, and Ruth, join in at any point. We're not used to not talking this long. We have a current smoking policy, and hopefully people know about that, but it has to do with buildings and residence halls and no smoking and vehicles around campus. And the like, and I won't review that. But a couple of reasons why Cornell might consider becoming smoke-free would be, number one, the health implications. If there were less people smoking on campus, theoretically there'd be less people smoking, and that would be healthy for the smokers themselves and for the people who would breathe in secondhand smoke.
And actually, there was an article in the New York Times a few months ago that was citing a new thing called third-hand smoke, which this would address. So not that you are in contact with someone right next to you smoking, but it's there in public areas and underground.
In addition to the health benefits, the University of Iowa, under President Skorton, became smoke-free. And so I think that's worth you knowing. They convened a committee bigger than the two of us, of stakeholders, to pull together a report which is available on the web. I could certainly send you the link if you wanted to see it. But as of July 1st, 2008, their policy went into action, and it reads, the University of Iowa is a smoke-free facility. Smoking is prohibited in any building, vehicle, or outdoor area owned, leased, or controlled by the university. So that's a big step. In looking at the universities, colleges and universities that have gone smoke-free, we would not be a trendsetter. There are many across the country, and there's a New York State initiative for this. And the interesting thing about Iowa is it's one of the only large-scale, and so we would benchmark against a university like Iowa because most of the other universities are much smaller. You could walk to the edge of the campus, for example. So that's why I bring that up. In addition, there is a savings estimate in the sustainability area for the grounds crew who feel that they pick up all the cigarette butts around the campus that are dropped, and that would save them at a minimum of $150,000 per year, not to mention all the money. So, we did gather some information from Gannett. One of the pieces of information was a survey that Gannett had done with students asking, actually, they did a survey with universities asking if a smoke-free policy affected your students applying to the school. And the results are written in the report that I sent to you, and basically, no, it's not affected. They also surveyed the students who, one of the outcome of the student survey on campus was that outdoor events should be smoke-free. So, like, Shulkoff should be smoke-free, is what they said. On the flip side, because there is another side, and I didn't put this in the report, but Ruth and I have gone to websites of universities that have gone smoke-free and read the blogs. And as you can imagine, there are people who feel that rights have been violated because smoking is legal. The outdoors is public. And so that would be a controversial thing for anybody who comes on campus.
Can I ask what's the cost of implementation? And by that I mean if we become a smoke-free campus, there's got to be signage, and we have a lot of visitors, we have a lot of cultures, we have a lot of traditions.
That's one of the cons. That's absolutely recognized.
But what's the cost to implement something? You know, it's $150,000 estimated for a large university to save in policing.
Right.
Okay, taking that at face value, what's the cost and sustainability of the signage and the enforcement?
Right. And we don't have a number, but that's a good point. Not only that, but if you're going to prohibit a behavior on campus, you should have some kind of behavioral tobacco cessation programming for people who are at this point having to quit. So we don't have a number for you, but that does need to be taken into consideration. I think that from a city perspective, when they talk about making places like the common smoke-free, the signage isn't a huge cost issue because it only needs to be posted legally at the limits of the city. So it could be something like that where it doesn't need to be signed all over, but it could be used in terms of what the city does, which is just the emphasis of campus.
My understanding is that the city of Ithaca, some of these streets that run through this campus, actually do not belong to Cornell, but to the city of Ithaca. Is that correct?
Not anymore? No, I'm sorry. Because it's becoming fewer and fewer.
It's taking me quite seriously.
Yeah.
What I'd like to say is that run through my list of the cons, and I know we won't have time for discussion today because we only have 10 minutes.
Right.
But kind of just get some ideas swirling around, and then if anybody wants to move further in a discussion, we can do that.
You should go to the University Health Board.
What we should do is have a discussion led by our liaison, whatever you guys come up with of this sort, because it really is a good matter to debate and discuss, but I think if we do it in this forum, there's not really any consequence to it, except that we're all better informed, which is not a bad consequence, but I think we need to get a more organized discussion and some kind of resolution Mm-hmm. So maybe we should, I mean, I don't want to speak for everybody.
I
just had one small question going off, but Mr. Blair said, would it be possible to contact University of Iowa to see what the costs were before and after?
Absolutely.
So we could have a tangible number to apply to this?
Yeah, I suspect if we are going to look into this, there'll be a lot of things that we can do in terms of contact. We contacted a few universities and didn't get very much information, but yeah, definitely.
I'm wondering what the how the decision process worked to figure out how much time it should take to come up with the idea and say, okay, now it's law. In terms of the human rights, the state. I mean, actually, I think this is a wonderful proposal, and and I like to see the university go smoke free. And I'm not sure how much time it should take to be fair.
Yeah, it took a long time for Iowa, I think.
Well, and recently the University of Buffalo went smoke-free and did it in a very suspicious manner, where one day they announced they were smoke-free.
Yeah, I think that's unfair. I think
it was very unfair, and they were enforcing policies, new policies that people weren't aware of.
How long did Iowa take?
They actually moved their deadline up a year. I'm not quite sure why, and this is something that we can certainly research a little bit more.
Yeah, I can send the link to that.
Because I'm sure some people will feel, geez, I sort of did want to stop smoking, maybe this is going to help me and stuff like that. There's some people that I think would probably say, yeah, just try it. And I know, I talked to them. But this seems like timing could help.
Okay, well, we have that piece of information.
Just a quick question for the future discussion. It's a larger issue here. On the benefit side, when you query the University of Iowa, I wonder if anybody collects statistics that show that there actually is a benefit in employee and student health. Because if that were the case, and you save money in the health budget, we're in a budget crisis here. We're going to be in a budget crisis in the next who knows how many years. If we could save money on health insurance, that's a very big expense for every corporation.
Right, and to piggyback with that, if there are, I think there are policies that discuss whether or not health, you have savings on health premiums if you are, I know for drinking that's the case, but maybe.
Yeah, there are numbers attached
to so
smokers.
Those things would be, useful to bring.
It sounds like a big and long-term study, but there may be some entity, some corporation, some other university that has actually looked at smoking prohibition and whether that showed up in better health. Because if it did, then it could be potentially a very big savings. Or not. I mean, people may eat more and get diabetes.
Yeah, the price of food should come down because people will eat more.
I think this is on our agenda for at least next month and then a month thereafter as we formulate the health services side of things. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you.
Okay, on to the Codes and Judicial Committee update resolution.
Okay, we were just discussing if we would like to start it over this day. Clearly, this is going to take much longer than 10 minutes.
Is this the gorge?
Yes,
of course.
I move to dismiss the resolution as.
Not in favor.
Here's an option, and that is that we have the issue presented to us, and then in 5 minutes, that's it, and then we all go back and talk to our various constituencies, get some opinions, and next month we can do a thorough item on it, 45 minutes or however. It would really be a lot better than having any preliminary discussion of it now. So if you would just present what it is that you're going to do, we can circulate all the information, and then everybody go back to your different assemblies and think about it, talk to people about it.
Should we not have them read it, first, second it, and then table it?
Friendly amendments too, so I can send out a revised version to you guys to read.
Okay, well, it doesn't make sense.
Could you also say how it originated, whose idea was it, what's the problem of interest?
Okay, the main, if you guys have copies of this, have you seen it?
It's up on the
right. IMT is the only one being added. The main objective behind the committee was to, it originated after the death this summer in the gorge. as far as legal liabilities and having no one want students dying, they decided something needed to be done if the campus had enough. Since many people apparently over the years have died in the gorges, it's something we talked about as a committee. And essentially, I don't want to be too one-sided. The CJC is very stringent when it comes to this issue. It's the makeup of the committee is CUPD, the JA's office, and legal advice from law school. They have a very one-sided opinion. I know AZA.
I just want to make a clarification before anything loaded happens from it. The JA office has non-voting representation, so I just want to qualify that one.
They do have non-voting. As far as undergraduates or students representative committee, it's me and one other girl. I know AZA works with Kathy's owner, CUPD, if you would like to comment on that.
So I'll talk a little bit. Originally, again, this all started with the death of Douglas Lowe over the summer. It didn't necessarily start. It was born again, basically, from the last time that someone actually had lost their life in the gorge. And so really what we had done is we started a committee. We had been meeting with CUPD, local officials, fire safety marshals, you name it, they were there at the meeting, and we were saying, you know, this is what we want to do. So the answer, the question was, you know, what can CUPD do? What can the local officials do? As well as what can the students do about this issue to get things done? And then pretty much this is a response, I guess, from CUPD. And this is what we have to go with. We can see the revised version later on. But certainly, I mean, there's a lot of interest from, I guess, all of our perspectives. We've been working this over a long time to sort of debate this. It may just be more worth it to table reading it or even doing everything if we don't have a revised version later on.
I think that's right. But you should circulate that as soon as we can. As the person who was on the CJC for a long time before I even got on this committee, I can say that the CJC thinks through lots of things. It's not as loaded, as you say, but it has a responsibility that it tries to bring to rational arguments to develop, and this is something we have to consider. It's our responsibility is to look at it, to talk to our various constituencies, and then come back here and debate. So rather than get into this is just a fascist attempt to keep us out of the War of the Gorges, we really have to look at it and think about all the different the different arguments, including the CJC's. And I think that's best done after we've read the thing and we've talked to our respective constituents.
Just for the record, he didn't say that.
He didn't say it. I said that.
No, I understand.
But he didn't say that.
And will you be somebody who can answer basic questions about what is the gaping legal liability?
Okay, stop for a second. Like that should be what happens next. That is, at the next meeting, we should have at least two representatives from the CJC here, who are, including Kathy Zoner, if she's willing, and maybe somebody from the JA's office.
No, this isn't as loaded as it sounds. True, the undergraduate representation on the committee is lower, but there's very strong arguments on both sides of this issue as far as legal liability, and as far as swimming in the gorges is actually legal in the city of Ithaca. On the other side, one of the main intangible issues that I have is will actually stop students from swimming in the gorge. I mean, you can look behind us and see that. You have to question also, I think, manpower, how enforceable is this?
These are things we really have to discuss next week or next month.
Right.
Okay.
I would just add, can I just, so it sounds like Jay will be here. Can we make sure that we have some people who are in opposition to this here? From the law side of it, because I think that there's definitely a very solid argument to be made that this is maybe overstepping.
Sorry, just another point of order. Maybe I wasn't clear enough before. The judicial administrator enforces the code, and like the non-voting representative does not take positions proposed amendments to the code. So I don't want there to even be a presumption that the judicial administrator has lobbied one way or the other to this.
Ace, actually, I have a question. Sure. And again, maybe this is getting into the language, and this is something maybe you need to research, or somebody can research it for our next meeting. But
you know, those waters officially designated, who's designating those? Like, who would be responsible for designating? Maybe that's getting into a little bit more depth than we should.
Yeah, I think it is.
Again, what I'll do is I'll bring the notes from all the meetings that we have had.
I'm assuming.
Right.
Next month, that's what we'll do. Now,
could we move it to the room that we had the campus planning forum in, the larger rooms, as far as presentation? I feel if we're going to have more individuals coming to speak to us, it might require more.
Awful room for discussion.
No. All right, so let's decide that between now and then.
Something
our announcement of our meeting is usually then.
Okay, do we want this at our next regular meeting? Because we also have a mid-month meeting on the schedule, which is a tentative.
Wait, are you saying what's next?
Our next,
it's either March 11th or it's 2 weeks after that.
Right. March 11th.
This isn't usually a meeting that we have because it's a mid-month meeting. If we feel, I mean, nobody's swimming in the gorges between now and March, the month of March, so this is not necessarily pressing in that regard, but do we want to move it up for 2 weeks from now or a month from now?
Do we have anything else? No.
I think in the fact that we're trying to bring multiple people to the meeting, maybe better to work with everyone's schedules from a month from now. So
okay. I would agree with that, yes.
We're talking
that's
about the deputy and all that.
It's the end of our regularly scheduled end of the month meeting in March.
Right.
Oh, okay. There was a campus planning committee meeting, and one of the things that came up for a second was whether cell phone towers should be put up like in the gorges so people can be in contact with cell phones any place, any time, for safety reasons. And then sort of a couple people said, you know, you sort of go there to get away because it's not safe in part, because it's not connected.
Okay.
Because
yeah. I know those are things that we'll talk about next time.
Or we can go up there and jump off by the diving board or something.
All right.
And now...
Now, this is something that goes...
Okay.
If you could just take one and pass it on.
All right. How long do you think this is going
to
take?
Well, maybe we not get to it.
Well,
but let's look at it.
We need to extend it.
This is the
member filed
request to consider a resolution support a letter or excuse me a statement of support for a resolution that's coming before the university. The faculty senate. Would you like to present?
I would. I will. Anyway, so many people.
Left me a note that I missed. Was the minutes approved?
No, we've not.
No. We will do that.
I move to approve the minutes. For minutes.
All in favor?
Thank you.
We've approved the minutes. It was on the list.
All right, so Elizabeth will be presenting.
It originally came, the argument of this resolution was in concern about a particular building, but which is the Milstein building, that it is very expensive, it is not environment, it is not a sustainable building. There are other issues. Other people have other issues with it not being appropriate for its setting, sort of dwarfing natural views and not being consistent with the historical setting, and so on. Cornell sort of, I think, bullied the local government, it would be a fairly accurate word, to get them to approve it. So then we came up with a resolution to include Milstein under the construction freeze, so there could be a little more consideration of the pros and cons, and whether there was some alternative way to get AAP some more studio space, and to comply with the real issue in accreditation, which is not the way AAP presents it, but I think the real issue was whether they were accessible for disabled people who might want to be architects or architecture professors, because they didn't have elevators. They've since actually put in two elevators in Sibley, and
this
larger
is not
bathrooms.
About the resolution,
and
though. We have to really
no.
speak
okay.
to the resolution.
All right, and so anyway, once the financial crisis sucked in, it became a much broader issue of how Cornell makes building decisions.
We have to extend the meeting.
I motion to extend the meeting by 10 minutes. Judging by the
all in favor. Passes unanimously.
Okay.
I think as we have fallen into financial crisis in the last few months, the original concerns that a lot of people had, which were more toward the, you know, the environmental end and so on, and now that the budget end of it becomes much more significant, we found out. We just had a faculty meeting in my department today, and it was. I mean, these things just get gloomy. Is not the word for it. You find out that there's such a bigger story out there of how the university got to the point it's at right now, which is not just about the stock market crash. It's about previous administrators going into a building binge and not having the money to support those buildings and thinking that the stock market would just go up forever and so the money would come rolling in. And that wasn't the case. They also, apparently, I just heard this today at a faculty meeting, but they were also going around sort of spending money that just didn't exist to the tune of over $200 million. Here and there to lure somebody here, give an extra lab to somebody you're trying to lure here, trying to keep here, and so on. And now you see, as in the bookstore budget that we have a table for, the university is going around confiscating reserves from departments. Talk about a tax. And so departments that were kind of frugal and kind of set some money aside for emergencies, the university's going around taking it. It's amazing. And we're being forced to cut into the meat of our programs, to cut faculty lines. My department's going to lose 4 faculty lines. And you cut graduate admissions. We know that student tuition is going up. And all this seems to sort of come back to very bad decisions about buildings. Hugely expensive buildings. That's not all of it, because the reserve issue, you know, sprinkling money around. But it was not, I think, just not good fiduciary behavior on the part of our administrators. So having a better system for making these decisions in which more people participate, and you don't have a situation, as with Milstein, where one dean, who was closely connected with the world's most expensive architect, Ruben Kumhoff, decided to forego all other designs submitted and throw the design to Ruben Kumhoff, who only builds glass jutting boxes. This is what he does. So we got a glass jutting box. Ruben Kumhoff mocks sustainability. Right. Of course, you know, you can't limit his artistic vision with such mundane notions. And so that you end up with a bad building. And you end up with a bad building that's supported by one dean, who then gets the provost. She's not here anymore. We could bring her back to defend it now. But so she backs him. You have like 2 people. And then the university decides to muscle it through and bully local governments and so on to get them to go along with this. That's not a good way to make decisions about spending millions and millions of dollars. And that's only one example. I think, you know, if we look at all the other buildings, we know that we're in a building frenzy now. Every undergraduate is aware that this is going to go on all the time that you're here, right? And this isn't the end of it, because if Milstein goes through, they're going to build a road through the Arts Pride to let the big, you know, construction vehicles
have time for debate.
Okay. So that's where the resolution came from. It's about making sure that we don't get more Milstein, but that, and we don't get more huge debt that now we're having to pay off by cutting into the core programs of the university.
Do you have an idea what percentage of our shortfall is due to these buildings?
I think a very lot of it.
We don't actually. We don't know,
but
debt servicing and things like that are all involved.
It's kind of like the textbook thing. You can color the money any way you want to. In reality, buildings are a big part, as is energy consumption, and so you can reasonably suppose that a large portion of it. But a couple of things, if I may, engage on what you said. The resolution that I've seen that was just passed out addresses making sure that they've secured essentially a plan for funding, a reasonable plan for funding before they...
So they're going to have to debt finance.
It does nothing to talk about your points that you raised as far as competitive designs or some...
No.
And you know, university process for building selection. Because I know the only thing I'm aware of, and I have not researched this at all, is that is my understanding, though, is that the trustees mandated eons ago that the buildings built here would be buildings of their time. So that's why we don't have a unified brick
architecture, the buildings built in the 50s.
Yeah, but we're not, this resolution doesn't address that, so I don't
correct.
Think we need to talk about it.
It's not about modern versus.
This is a financial only resolution.
Right, that's right.
And you're purporting that they do not do this now. That they start with 25, 30, 40% of their funds, and
not
the rest,
that much.
The rest
not
will
that.
Arrive
and they think
when needed.
The rest will arrive when needed, and it doesn't. And debt financing, you have to pay interest on the debt, and then that's, I think, a big part of the problem right now.
I just have one comment to make. This wasn't the case with Milstein, but usually naming rights to a building are given with 50% of the funds.
Right.
But when you say funding, full funding, I mean, the university assumes that most capital projects are going to be at least partially debt funded. It's in the operating plan. I mean, that's just like when you build a house, how many people actually have all of the money in hand to pay the builder? I mean, last night our president said, we need to extend consumer credit so that people can get mortgages and so on, businesses. And so I think that piece of it isn't something that you can really require.
Well, it could see it as a short term move that we don't take on even more debt financing when we've got such a huge debt to pay off. One could see this as a short term move and a first step.
Any other comments? Questions?
I actually have several comments or questions, and I don't know if we have time to really cover it here. I was wondering about the funding too, and the same thing. You know, does full funding mean you have to have all the money without any debt, and I don't think that is realistic. I think you gotta have a realistic picture on it. It talks about securing the full funding of the construction and operation, and I'm not sure what's meant by operation. Is that the you have to have funding for the annual budget once it's up and running, or I don't know.
Normally
what means.
People do with chickens.
Mm-hmm. And it also talks about financing ability should be made available in advance to the campus community, and I'm wondering what in advance means before they start, before they make the decision on the design, before they make the decision on the campus.
That actually is in the operating plan also, though. I mean, there are line items in the operating plan that shows that.
I'm not sure.
In the case of Mills, I think the budgeting has been very hidden, and you find out that well, when they say they've got 30% of the funding or 40%, it means that they're assuming they can grab a particular fund that was left as a bequest for programs in architecture, and they want to grab that for a building for all of AAP and so on. And so if these things were made public and you had a chance to look at that, what they're assuming about where the money would come from, then, you know, the argument about it, I think just the idea is just to broaden the conversation and to make us realize that if we spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on one building, that means that should be seen in the overall picture of the university, and everything has sort of zero-sum aspects. If we're going to spend a huge amount for a building on one part of the campus, it inevitably is going to mean less money for other parts of
it. Right. But I got to say, the intent of this, I understand, and part of which I'm sympathetic to. But the words in something like this are really going to matter. Attracting state-of-the-art world faculty implies labs. Some buildings, if you're going to deal with the DOE kind of facility, is a more expensive building.
We got the lab building.
We're not going to have time today. I don't know how to properly table this in the time we've got left. There's a thought here that I think the University Assembly should address, but the words on this have got to be carefully vetted.
Let me tell you, we're not voting approval of this resolution because this resolution is not even presented to us for action. This is going to be presented to the Senate, where I expect there's going to be lots of debate about it. It's already been put on the agenda for the next Senate meeting.
And when?
2 weeks from now, is that right?
So that's the March 11th,
right? And so what we constructed as a possibility for this was some kind of statement of support for the effort to open up the process of discussing the building, the process of funding and building on the campus to broader transparency, more transparency in this process. Now, I just want to finish. And I realize that, I mean, it's very cumbersome. in some ways, this should be a part of our sustainability, you know, program with our sustainability committee. And it is a little bit difficult for us to vote on something, to support something that isn't really final or formal anyway. So I'm asking maybe if there's some kind of interim way that either we don't have to vote necessarily, we could probably take a straw vote to express our concern about or interest in developing these issues more. Yeah.
Well, I would propose that we hear from both Paul Streeter, who's now responsible for preparing the operating plan for next year, and Ted Bott, maybe, to talk about that. Because I mean, if people have questions to be answered about debt financing and all those other issues, and also I mean some of the issues that Elizabeth raised. I
support that thought. If we're going to talk about a resolution of this kind of context to the present university, those are the people I think of.
Yeah.
If we're going to write a resolution or a statement of support from the University Assembly directly to the Faculty Senate for transparency and better oversight,
that's
especially during these times, then that's a whole different matter. This, I realize that problem in front of us says we call it on the President Scorton.
Mm-hmm.
So there's...
Right. No, it's the latter that we were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and this was just a talking point, a talking point for it. It's the latter, it's an expression of support for efforts that are now being promoted in this resolution to develop more transparency about budgeting.
Let me also give you guys a heads up that I've been trying to get the president and the provost to come to see us. It's been a little challenging in scheduling. I think maybe we might have to have a special meeting in March, but I've asked them to give me 2 weeks' notice.
Okay.
In order to get us to talk to them. And it would probably be on a Friday afternoon. Just to give you guys a heads up on that.
I was just going to say, I mean, I understand having written an article also on those themes, I understand where this is coming from, but in terms of the Faculty Senate meeting, which is coming up in a week and a half, I mean, there's literally not much we can do at this point,
right,
at this meeting to
right,
construct something officially, unless we utilize a listserv to, I guess, I don't know even how we can do a vote or something
right,
official. So, I mean, at this point, I would suggest we were talking about having some emergency meeting on March 11th, that all of us go to that Faculty Senate meeting instead and voice our support or our voices there as members of the University Assembly.
So we'll be competing with the architect.
No, it's a process thing. My understanding, I don't have to do a charter in front of me, is that the constituent assemblies have, it's not their sole reporting relationship, but have a reporting relationship to UA, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So if an assembly or the Faculty Senate adopts a resolution, it can be brought to the University Assembly for a further endorsement. But as far as the University Assembly sets the agenda of the Faculty Senate or influencing the Faculty Senate that way,
it's a pre-endorsement. It's a pre-endorsement, don't you? You've heard of those.
I recommend...
It's a pre-product endorsement.
I recommend we
don't get any money for it, though.
Let's bring this back to our March meeting. We will have had the action of the Faculty Senate.
Yeah.
If they have some type of resolution and they so ask us, we can then move to support it,
yeah,
if we so choose.
Yeah.
And leave it at that.
Good.
Everybody in agreement?
Agreed.
So in a month from now, we're going to talk about both the doors and this in an hour and a half.
But this may be much shorter because
it may be much
shorter. The Faculty Senate does with it.
Well, is anybody in support of bringing Paul Streeter here to talk to us about this?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I
think it would be not next meeting though, because that would be too long. But I think April meeting might work.
And that will be after the trustees meeting also.
That's
so
true.
Right.
Read the front page of the Ithaca Journal, which says that universities are cutting back on building high-profile buildings.
May I have a motion to adjourn?
Trading on.
I make a motion to adjourn.
Second. All in favor?
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.